is momentum now to transform this state of war into a permanent peace. And that's where we need Americans to recognize this is America's oldest war. It's on our responsibility to bring closure to this war.
Christine Ahn, founder and executive director of Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women mobilizing to end the Korean War. Also the coordinator of the campaign Korea Peace Now. That does it for our show. On Saturday, Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez will be speaking at 10 a.m. at American University in Washington on an all-day conference titled In Search of a New U.S. Policy for a New Latin America, Burying 200 Years of the Monroe Doctrine. Check democracynow.org for details. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Soul Queens and Blues Kings, making a real concert on Sunday, May 7th from 4:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. Norman Boogie Cat, Sylvester, and band bring together regional rhythm and blues acts for a night of music and dance as a benefit for healthcare for all Oregon. Again, that's Soul Queens and Blues Kings making a real concert on Sunday, May 7th from 4:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Support for this program comes from KBOO members and from the League of Women Voters of Portland, providing nonpartisan election information for the May special election at lwvpdx.org. The website has explanations of ballot measures on services for renters and for children and public safety. The League informs voters because every vote matters.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an Oregon audit suggests the state's cannabis rules might be outdated.
Secretary of State Shamia Fagan recuses herself from that audit for a conflict of interest.
And a statewide ban on styrofoam heads to the governor's desk.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 28th, 2023. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm P. Dubb. Oregon State auditors released a report Thursday about regulation in the state's cannabis industry. Many of their findings suggest that the industry is overregulated. This is because marijuana was legalized in Oregon in 2014, one of the first in the nation. At that point, the state was concerned about federal backlash and intervention since marijuana is still illegal federally. The audit suggests that some of the state's regulation might be overkill since the federal government hasn't gone after state-level cannabis industries across the nation. The audit calls out mandatory steel frame doors and 24-hour surveillance as potentially unnecessary security requirements. It also said the state system of tracking cannabis from seed to sale was getting too expensive and that the freeze on licenses should be rethought. The audit also called out the state's economic development agency, Business Oregon, which doesn't help cannabis businesses owners with grants. Other states have given grants to cannabis business owners, and it helps to solve an equity issue for those who can afford to start their own business.
That audit of the state's cannabis regulations was a bit overshadowed by a revelation first reported by Willamette Week. That is, that Secretary of State Shamia Fagan recused herself from this audit because she took on a consulting job for an embattled Oregon weed chain. Back in February, Fagan became a consultant for Vareed Holding LLC, an affiliate of Cannabis cannabis chain LaModa. LaModa's owners have racked up millions in unpaid federal and state taxes and have been sued repeatedly by vendors for not paying bills. They've also given to big influential Democrats in the state, including Fagan and Governor Tina Kotek. Typically, elected officials ask for recommendations from the Oregon Government Ethics Commission in writing if they think there might be a conflict of interest. Secretary of State Fagan did not do this. Instead, she called the office a few times for advice, but there isn't a paper trail of what her contract with LaModa entails or how it might impact her work. 5 days before starting work at LaModa, Fagan told her staff she would recuse herself from further work on the audit. But that is months after her office began their auditing work of the OLCC. Public officials have to file an economic statement each year about any income they get outside of their elected position. Fagan was hired as a consultant this year and has not reported consulting income in the past 2 years in office. Fagan says her work with the company was not related to their Oregon operations, but cannabis businesses in other states.
Say goodbye to styrofoam takeout containers. The Oregon legislature passed a law to ban polystyrene. That includes things like dishware for takeout, packing peanuts, and coolers. It comes from Senate Bill 543, which also prohibits the use of PFAS or forever chemicals in food packaging. The bill is headed to the governor's desk for signature. It will take effect in January 2025. Portlanders are already familiar with this change. Polystyrene has been banned in the city already. Another bill in the legislature would also tackle plastic pollution. Senate Bill 545 directs the Oregon Health Authority to update the state health code to make it easier for restaurants to allow people to bring their own reusable containers for takeout. State Senator Janine Solman from Hillsborough sponsored both bills. She said, quote, "Products that have a forever impact on our planet, like polystyrene foam, which doesn't biodegrade, and PFAS, forever chemicals that build up in our bodies and environment, should be eliminated." She continued, quote, "As we move away from these wasteful and harmful plastic products, we should make it easier for Oregon businesses to offer reusable options to help make the zero-waste future we are working to build a reality," end quote.
Washington state lawmakers have passed legislation that's designed to increase staff who can provide dental care to address the state's shortage. The new law will authorize dental therapists to assist providers. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Legislation passed in Olympia this year will provide more dental care access to underserved communities. House Bill 1678 authorizes dental therapists to work in community health clinics or federally qualified health centers. Head of the statewide Poverty Action Network, Marcy Bowers, says the new law will allow more staff capacity to dental care teams in these facilities to assist dentists.
Those providers are able to see more patients, can get out into more community settings to provide basic care, and I think as importantly, are able to find providers from their community to work in their communities as well.
More than 2 million Washingtonians have a dental care provider shortage in their area. Bowers says the dental therapist model has been successful in tribal settings in Washington and in other states. The Washington State Dental Association opposed the legislation, saying it could create safety issues. Bowers notes that many of the patients at health centers are low income, and dental therapists will help reduce the cost of care. She says groups have been working for more than a decade in Washington state to authorize dental therapists, and members of the community were overjoyed at its passage.
To be able to hear community members say, wow, thank you so much for pushing for so long to do something that means so much to us, that maybe we can concentrate more at work, we can not feel embarrassed about our teeth, maybe we can smile again in public.
In another effort to increase access to dental care and address the provider shortage issue in the state, lawmakers also passed House Bill 1466 this session. The bill will make it easier for dental hygienists to move from other states to practice sooner. Both bills are on Governor Jay Inslee's desk awaiting his signature. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Portland has long been the largest city in the country to have a police force that doesn't wear body cameras. That's about to change. Portland City Council members voted unanimously Wednesday for police to start wearing those devices. City attorneys and the union representing the police officers finally came to an agreement after almost 2 years of negotiation. Deputy City Deputy City Attorney Heidi Brown presented those details of the amendment during the City Council meeting Wednesday.
What is in this body camera policy? I'm going to hit the highlights for you and happy to answer any questions, of course. I want to note what we started it with, the purpose of the policy. In this, we acknowledge that body cameras are an accountability tool that can enhance transparency and understanding of interactions between officers and the public. We acknowledge as well, they help police in building and maintaining public trust. I think that's a real interest of ours. And that was encapsulated in the policy itself right at the start. Who wears them? All on-duty sworn members in uniform assignment who are displaying a badge, who take part in CERT, patrol, traffic, public order event operations, and special duty work. We included in there an adjustment time for unintentional errors for a 60-day period. Intentional errors are always subject to discipline, even during that adjustment period. We included that officers must notify people when they are being recorded. And then we got into the next section, deals with activation. And we list out when a body camera must be turned on to record. We've included in there, one of the benefits of coming late to body cameras is that there's a lot of new technology out there, which is pretty neat. And one of the things is this automatic activation of the cameras. And so we have three instances where we've agreed that the cameras will just automatically turn on. When an officer turns on their overhead lights, that will start the cameras. When an officer takes out their taser, that will activate the camera. And third, when an officer draws their firearm, that will activate the camera. So automatically in those instances. Next, we got into when does the officer manually need to turn it on? So one, when they're dispatched to a call, they're required to turn it on. Second, when engaging with the public during a protest, they're required to turn it on, provided that it's allowed by law. When pulling someone over in their car or stopping a pedestrian, they're required to turn it on. When asking for consent to search or attempting to do a search, they turn it on. During certain custodial interviews of juveniles, they turn it on. And lastly, when the member develops reasonable suspicion or probable cause that a crime or violation either has occurred, is occurring, or will occur, they are required to turn it on. And that last aspect of the policy, when they have to turn it on, that's required by the state law on body cameras. So that language is pulled directly from state law. We have exceptions. We have times when an officer may mute or deactivate their camera. In particular, they have to deactivate their camera when they're interviewing a sexual assault victim, unless the victim consents and wants to have it turned on, and when in a medical facility. We next address when they stop recording. When they're done having contact with a person or participating in a call, the recording ends. We address the upload and the storage of footage. This was another issue the public had a lot of interest in. We said on the upload, it's at the end of the shift. For a use of deadly force incident, the supervisor will come and take control of the body camera, and then they will deal with ensuring that it gets to homicide detectives or wherever it's needed to get uploaded. On storage, we made it very clear in this policy that we do not allow for tampering with, for manipulating or altering content, or deleting recordings. Frankly, the camera itself, you cannot do it. It physically isn't possible on that camera.
That was Deputy City Attorney Heidi Brown. The last sticking point between the Portland Police Union and the city was about when officers could see their body camera footage after a use of force incident. The city wanted officers to write the reports before viewing their camera footage. The police union wanted officers to be able to view footage and then do their forms. As the agreement now stands, officers who seriously injure someone, use force against someone with a mental illness, or against someone who has been handcuffed will give a recorded statement to their supervisor before viewing their body camera footage and writing their report.
For the lowest levels of force, like pointing a gun without firing it, officers will give a non-recorded statement to their supervisor before viewing footage. When a Portland police officer kills someone, they will not be allowed to view their body camera footage until after giving an initial statement to internal affairs investigators. Investigators won't be allowed to view the footage until after taking the officer's initial statement. The body cameras are required under a 2014 settlement agreement between the city and the U.S. Department of Justice over police using excessive force against people in a mental health crisis. The Justice Department told the city in November 2021 that officers should not be allowed to view any footage before writing use of force reports. DOJ attorneys tentatively signed off on the proposed policies, but said it doesn't meet their initial requirements. Critics expressed concern that the camera policies were not made public until last week, so the public did not get an opportunity to provide feedback. Civil rights groups say some components of the policies limit how useful they can be to hold police accountable. After a 60-day pilot, the city and the police union will meet to discuss mutually agreeable modifications to the policies before they are fully adopted. Training on the cameras is expected to begin in August, and they will be given to select officers soon thereafter.
Washington State workers are marching on Sunday before May Day, also known as International Workers' Day. The march is taking place in Northwest Washington, which has a heavy concentration of farm workers. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Workers in Washington State are holding a march this weekend ahead of May Day, which commemorates the workers' rights movement around the world. The march is taking place on Sunday in Mount Vernon, a town in Northwest Washington with a large farm worker community. Lalo Juarez is an organizer with Community to Community Development, a grassroots organization dedicated to food sovereignty and immigrant rights that's hosting the march, which says is meant to bring together laborers of every kind.
It's for recognizing all workers and bringing all of community together, especially the immigrant community that don't have a lot of help.
The march begins at 10 a.m. at Edgewater Park in Mount Vernon. May Day is traditionally celebrated on May 1st and marks worker struggles around the world. It's a national public holiday in many countries. Washington State has implemented rules to protect farm workers in hot weather, such as requiring employers to ensure there are rest and water breaks. Juarez says the rules haven't gone far enough.
The truth is, as a farm worker, I really didn't see those rules being applied at the field where I was working. And so we're asking the state to hold the company accountable and make sure they are following those rules.
Juarez also is pushing for an immigrant resource center in Bellingham. He says the center wouldn't be for just farm workers, but would help many of them, especially those who don't speak English as a first language. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Trump holds a campaign event in New Hampshire and criticizes Biden's handling of the economy. The Biden administration announces new immigration measures as Title 42 is set to expire in days, and former VP Pence appears in a federal court to testify before the January 6th grand jury. With more on those stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This country needs a rescuing. We have to rescue America from the wreckage of the Biden economy. Under my leadership, we built the greatest economy in the history of the world.
Former President Donald Trump at a campaign event in New Hampshire on Thursday hammered President Joe Biden's handling of the economy. Trump said when he left the White House, Biden was handed the fastest economic recovery with no inflation. The event follows Biden's official 2024 re-election campaign announcement earlier this week. On Thursday, the Biden administration announced initiatives to establish immigration processing centers throughout Latin America to help mitigate the number of migrants coming to the United States. Title 42 allowed the federal government to ban people from entering the U.S. due to the COVID-19 public health emergency, but that is set to expire May 11th. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said they will prioritize legal immigration pathways for migrants, but did call the situation a hemispheric challenge that demands hemispheric solutions.
We are building lawful pathways for people to come to the United States without resorting to the smugglers. At the same time, we are imposing consequences on those who do not use those pathways and instead irregularly migrate to our southern border.
Internal Revenue Service Commissioner Daniel Werfel spoke about IRS accountability and oversight before the House Ways and Means Committee on Thursday. Werfel's appearance comes as House Republicans passed a bill Wednesday that would cut the $80 billion in extra funding the IRS secured through the Inflation Reduction Act. Democratic Representative Mike Thompson told Werfel, while things such as customer service have improved, more work needs to be done, as his wife was on the phone with the agency for hours.
I know we have more work to do. But what worries me, Congressman, is if we reduce our funding, we'll hear more stories like
that.
FBI Director Christopher Wray spoke before a House Appropriations Subcommittee regarding Biden's 2024 budget. The president is asking $11.4 billion to go to the agency to carry out its mission. California Representative Mike Garcia still posed some concerns about how much the FBI would be allocated.
I'm concerned that the president, in a year where he is at the top line, asked for about, a 12% increase across all federal agencies, only asked for a 0.3% increase for your budget. That, to me, messages to Congress that he doesn't value the mission of the FBI, frankly.
Ray says the threats the FBI handles are more sophisticated and move more quickly than ever before. He says the requests and the budget reflect those threats. Finally, former Vice President Mike Pence testified before a federal grand jury investigating Trump's effort to overturn the 2020 election. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sona Lee. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will continue to be warm into the evening with some clouds coming in and an overnight low of 55 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be 79 and sunny before cooling down some of the rest of the weekend. Today in history. In 1967, boxer Muhammad Ali refuses his induction into the United States Army during the Vietnam War and is subsequently stripped of his championship and license. The quote of the day is from U.S. Supreme Court Associate Justice Elena Kagan, who was born today in 1960. She is the fourth woman to serve on the court. She said, quote, "The Supreme Court, of course, has responsibility of ensuring that our government never oversteps its proper bounds or violates the rights of individuals. But the court must also recognize the limits on itself and respect the choices made by the American people."
Southeastern Oregon Mountain is getting a new name in honor of a Kalapuya chief, Jalito. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez in National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A mountain 35 miles southeast of Eugene, Oregon, has been officially renamed to something less controversial. As KLCC's Brian Bull explains, Swastika Mountain is no more.
The new name for the roughly 4,200-foot-high peak is Mount Halo. The name is derived from Kalapuya Chief Jalito, whose village was 20 miles west of the mountain. David Lewis is an assistant professor of anthropology and ethnic and indigenous studies at Oregon State University, and a member of the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde. He says while some people have defended the swastika as a universal symbol for many cultures, its more recent associations are troubling.
The symbol has really negative connotations from World War II and its use as a symbol of fascism, and so we need to at times revisit names that have been given to the land and to rivers and towns and maybe replace those with things that have more resonance with today's society.
The U.S. Board of Geographic Names approved the name change at its April 13th meeting, and it takes effect immediately. Lewis says the entire process began a year and a half ago. I'm Brian Bull.
Voters on the Blackfeet Nation have elected a replacement for a council member who recently resigned following his arrest. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton has more.
Blackfeet Disaster and Emergency Services Director Robert DeRozier won the election and will take over the Browning seat on the Blackfeet Tribal Business Council. The Blackfeet Nation held a special election Tuesday to fill the vacant post of former chairman Tim Davis. Tribal council members last year voted to remove Davis as chairman after 9 people, including family members, were arrested at Davis's home on drug-related charges. Davis continued to serve on the council. Davis was arrested in March for disorderly conduct and threatening a public official. The council planned to hold an expulsion hearing, but Davis resigned shortly after the hearing was announced. I'm Aaron Bolton.
After the final public comment hearing for South Dakota's proposed social studies standards, the State Board of Education standards voted to approve the proposal, though strong opposition remains. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's C.J. Keene has more.
After well over 1,000 opposing comments from South Dakotans, the embattled standards proposal sailed to passage on a 5-2 vote. From the onset, the proposal was panned by the state's education and Native communities. Sherry Johnson is the education director of the Sisseton-Wahpeton tribe, and she says many are unhappy with the role the Native community is slated with.
For a great part, you know, all of Native American are portrayed warlike, and Native Americans are made to feel embarrassed about that role. That's when Governor Noem says she doesn't want divisive. Well, that itself is divisive to Native American people. The right to vote is missing for Native Americans. The Native American Religious Act, you know, that was only passed in 78. I mean, these things are huge.
Voices like that swayed some board members.
Board President Terry Nebelsick announced his opposition at the end of the hearing in Pierre.
By statute, these hearings are put in place to determine if the citizens of South Dakota have any concerns with the standards recommended by the revision committee that the statute indicates should be made up of South Dakota educators and professionals. These hearings should not be a debate with point-counterpoint. There is no win-win in this process. The longer it's gone on, it's become obvious that it will be a lose-lose endeavor.
Despite the opposition, board member Phyllis Heineman was unmoved.
I found these standards, and I'll be very honest, I found them very exciting. When I read through some of this information, and so I got to thank the governor for starting the conversation.
Within minutes of passage, a representative from Governor Kristi Noem's camp sent a release applauding the passage of the standards. Implementation of the new standards package will begin in June and take place over the next 2 years.
That was CJ Keene, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A state government official in Texas has announced that employees who come to his office not dressed, quote, in a manner consistent with their biological gender, quote, will face consequences. It's another in a list of hostile actions aimed at LGBTQ people, which will likely lead to new lawsuits the state will have to defend. Roz Brown reports.
New lawsuits are likely coming to Texas as LGBTQ people working for the state are now being targeted in dress code regulations. Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller has issued an order to his employees to dress in a manner consistent with their biological gender as part of a dress code and grooming policy. ACLU of Texas attorney Brian Klosterboer says the new policy violates Title VII, which bans employment discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity, as well as the First Amendment's right to free expression and the Equal Protection Clause.
Unfortunately, it sends a pretty devastating message to people who work at this department that they're not welcome if they deviate at all from gender stereotypes.
The memo, dated April 13th and signed by Miller, says those found to be in violation will be asked to go home and change. It further states those who don't adhere can face remedies up to and including termination. The agency's previous dress code restrictions did not reference biological gender. Klosterboer believes state agencies should be focused on doing their jobs, not trying to make political points by discriminating against their own employees.
They're trying to take us back in time to the decades when the government and private employers could and openly did discriminate based on gender, but that really defies modern court precedent as well as the regulation from federal agencies.
As Ag Commissioner, Miller is known for his fondness of Western wear. To that end, his new dress code encourages Western business attire, including boots, but not open-toed shoes for women.
It's just pretty absurd that people are allowed to wear Western wear, but not to dress consistently with their gender identity. And it's unclear and vague how they're even going to enforce this. Are they going to be picking and choosing between cowboy hats, which one is too masculine or feminine?
The Agriculture Commissioner has previously advocated for statewide legislation to restrict gender-affirming care for transgender children. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
Moving to news about our planet, blades from wind turbines, as well as solar panels, have an average lifespan of 25 to 30 years. As more of these renewable energy sources are installed, efforts continue to make good use of the parts after they've been decommissioned. Mike Moen has the details in North Dakota.
As Earth Month wraps up, more attention is being given to how to make use of wind and solar components at the end of their useful lives, and it includes emerging research in North Dakota. Wind turbines and solar farms are viewed as vital parts of the world's transition to renewable energy. But folks with North Dakota's Energy and Environmental Research Center say the region will eventually have to make plans for more than 1,500 turbines using 4,500 blades as these systems are upgraded or retired. The EERC's Josh Strake has been leading research into this area. It says these blades are made up of a lot of different materials.
Our focus has largely been on, is there a way we can separate material A from material B?
His team suggests it would be more optimal to do that separation at the wind turbine site so large blades don't have to be transported and left to sit in a landfill. Strake says more research funding is needed to lay out an efficient process that would allow more of these blade parts to be reused, recycled, or repurposed. And it isn't just wind at the center of this movement. Karen Drozdiak of First Solar, the nation's largest solar panel maker, says her company has been at the leading edge of establishing a global recycling program.
We focus not just on recovering the glass and frame materials, but we've also achieved closed-loop recovery of the semiconductor material in our solar panels, and that's being used to manufacture new solar panels.
Her company has its own in-house recycling facilities, but Drozdiak suggests broader investments within the sector are needed to keep more solar panel materials in circulation after their first run. The International Renewable Energy Agency estimates that end-of-life solar panels could provide a recoverable value of $15 billion by 2050. Most wind and solar systems have a lifespan of about a quarter century. Mike Moen, Prairie News Service.
American Forest. Free online tool assigns tree equity scores to neighborhoods across the U.S., allowing cities and residents to advocate for tree planting projects where they're needed most. Dr. Anthony Leowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Tree-lined streets are beautiful and beneficial. Trees absorb planet-warming carbon dioxide as they grow and help keep urban areas cool on hot summer days. But some city neighborhoods have few trees,